From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, dying in prison. We'll hear from a dying inmate, prison nurses, and a warden who handles funeral arrangements. They spoke with our prison correspondent, Wilbert Rideau, editor emeritus of The Angolite, the news magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, where Rideau is serving a life sentence. A new PBS special pays tribute to lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. We'll talk with Hammerstein's son, Jamie, who handles the Hammerstein estate and has directed many revivals of his father's musicals. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Under One Roof, a new dramatic series starring James Earl Jones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros says he won't resign his office. Attorney General Janet Reno says she's asked a 3-judge panel for permission to appoint an independent counsel to look into allegations that Cisneros lied to the FBI about payments made to an ex-lover. Cisneros says he hasn't violated the public's trust. He predicts he will be cleared of any criminal wrongdoing. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says Israel and Syria will soon reopen talks on a peace treaty. He says military chiefs from both countries will join diplomats in the bargaining. Christopher made the announcement after a day of talks in Damascus. It had seemed earlier that the negotiations might fall apart. President Clinton is blocking a U.S. oil company's deal to develop 2 Persian Gulf oil fields for Iran. White House spokesman Mike McCurry says the president stopped the Conoco deal because of Iran's actions and policies.
We're issuing that order pursuant to our overall policy of trying to contain and isolate Iran as it continues to sponsor terrorism, as it continues to undermine the Middle East peace process, as it pursues weapons of mass destruction and the means of delivering those weapons of mass destruction. And we've worked energetically and to try to press our arguments on the government of Iran that it should cease such unacceptable behavior.
The New York Times says the deal also faced opposition from 3 influential members of Conoco's parent company, DuPont. President Clinton today lashed out at congressional Republicans for targeting education in their ongoing budget deliberations. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Hundreds of parent-teacher associations meeting in Washington gave President Clinton a rousing welcome, but in a brief, somewhat somber speech, the president said that after years of bipartisan agreement over school reform, education had become both a partisan and divisive issue. He singled out Republicans in the House of Representatives for wanting to eliminate funding for his Safe and Drug-Free Schools program, funds for teaching homeless children, and for parent resource centers. Government can and should be cut, the president said, but government cannot walk away from kids without jeopardizing the nation's future.
Trying to cut back on education right now would be like trying to cut the defense budget in the toughest days of the Cold War.
The National PTA has vowed to converge on Congress this week and demand that $1.7 billion in cuts be put back into the Education Department's budget. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The National Labor Relations Board has told baseball owners it will issue an unfair labor practice complaint against them. A lawyer for the owners says the complaint charges the teams didn't properly follow the rules of collective bargaining when they got rid of salary arbitration and rules relating to free agency. The action could set the stage for the agency to seek an injunction in federal court against the owners. This could lead to the players ending their strike. That, some say, could lead the owners to lock out the players. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 27 points. This is NPR. Researchers say women who are artificially inseminated should be aware that there is a small risk of getting an infectious disease like AIDS from the procedure. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has established guidelines for screening semen donors for HIV infection. There is no mandatory training or special licensing required to do artificial insemination. According to a study published in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association, the threat of HIV infection from artificial insemination is not merely theoretical. Looking back at 5 clinics, researchers found 7 women who underwent the procedure and became infected with HIV as a result. All 7 cases occurred before 1986, when most clinics began voluntary donor screening. A CDC official says that while artificial insemination is generally safe, women should insist that all potential semen donors be screened for HIV as a precaution. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
North Korea is being warned again about its nuclear program. South Korea is warning the North it could face international sanctions if it lifts its nuclear program freeze. The North signed a deal, agreeing to give up its old nuclear reactors in exchange for new ones. This is intended to prevent the North from using old nuclear material for weapons. But now the North says it doesn't want the new reactors if they're made in South Korea, and the North is threatening to restart its nuclear program if a new maker of reactors isn't found by April 21st. U.S. diplomat Robert Gallucci, who arranged the deal, says he thinks North Korea will realize it will lose if it doesn't compromise. The United Nations says 9 French peacekeepers were killed and 4 hurt today when their trailer went off a mountain road south of Sarajevo. It fell more than 120 feet. This is the largest number of peacekeepers to die in Bosnia. The French defense minister is to fly to Sarajevo today. Meanwhile, the top UN envoy in Bosnia says there's no progress in his negotiation effort. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A growing number of inmates is facing dying in prison. This is in part because of AIDS, but mainly it's the result of longer sentences and reductions in the use of parole, which are leading to the graying of the prison population. The number of prisoners age 60 or older in state and federal institutions is doubling every 4 years. And a few years ago, federal prisons stopped the practice of sending some old and terminal inmates home to die. Dying in prison and medical care for dying inmates is the subject of today's report by our prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau. He's the editor emeritus of The Angolite, the news magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, where he's serving a life sentence. Louisiana is at the forefront of the trend toward tougher sentencing. Louisiana has had a policy of life sentences without parole for 20 years. Wilbert Rideau joins us by phone from Angola. Are there more people dying in prison now?
Yes, very much so. This primarily due to the fact that more people are in prison and more people are being kept in prison for longer periods of time. And they're getting older in prison. In 1978, the average age of Angola inmates was about 20. Today, half of the 4,600 guys here are over the age of 39, which I guess we're gradually turning into the world's largest old folks home.
Wilbert, is that something you notice all the time? Is that something you can feel that you've observed?
How can you avoid it? You look in the mirror. Hell, I'm 53 years old. I look all around me. Most of the prisoners I know, they've got gray in their hair. Wrinkles in their face. They're old. It's a visible thing. You can see it.
What happens after death when somebody dies in prison?
Well, Tara, I talked to Assistant Warden Gary Frank, who handles all of this here at the prison.
Every inmate here has a emergency address, and we notify the next of kin. Either I will notify the next of kin. Normally, it's the chaplain's department. Notifies the next of kin. We talk to those individuals, either a wife, children, a mother, a father, and give them information about their son or husband or whatever, and they make decision whether or not to claim the remains. If they do claim the remains, then a funeral home does come up here and pick the body up here at the penitentiary. If they did not claim the remains, then the penitentiary will do the necessary things to ensure that the body is buried.
How many inmates were unclaimed last year?
We had 3 inmates that were unclaimed last year. Well, 1994.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do with the unclaimed remains? I mean, what do you do with them?
Well, it's the state's responsibility to ensure that the body is buried. We call several of the funeral homes in the surrounding area. We receive bids from the funeral homes, and we take the lowest bid. And the average cost this last year was around $600 per funeral that the funeral home charged us for the burial.
Okay. And what happens? Somebody come and pick up?
We do have a funeral home that comes and prepares the body for burial. The inmate is usually buried in his prison clothing. There's no special arrangements as far as clothing is concerned. A casket is prepared. The inmate is placed in the casket. We do have a cemetery here at the institution, and the inmate is buried at the institution. We do have a small graveside service by the chaplain's department. And on some occasions, we do have some of the friends of the inmate. We do allow them to attend the graveside service, and some of them participate in the funeral also.
And how large is your cemetery?
The name of the cemetery is Point Lookout Cemetery. The old cemetery has been filled, was filled probably within the last 6 months, and we've moved to another cemetery across the street. And this may sound a little gruesome, but I did an estimate. I had to see how many people we could bury in that cemetery, and we can bury over 2,000 people in that cemetery, in the new cemetery. So that will last us for the years to come.
Okay. Well, you happen to have 2,400 inmates saving life here.
That's correct.
Is that in preparation?
No, that's not in preparation for all those people.
The bodies that go unclaimed, based on your experience, is it due to poverty or they just don't want?
Most of the people do not have the funds to defray the cost of the funeral. That is 99.9% of the problem. They do not have the funds to do that. And I imagine a funeral today will cost thousands of dollars in the free world, and they just don't have the money to do that. And I can understand that. And again, those people are very sincere about it. And we try to be as helpful as possible in this area, and I think we do a good job in that area.
That was Gary Frank, assistant warden at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, talking with our prison correspondent, Wilbert Rideau. Wilbert, do other prisons in Louisiana follow the same procedures as they do in Angola when taking care of funeral arrangements and burials?
I think they basically do. One thing they have in common is that other prisons utilize our same Point Lookout Cemetery for burying its inmates. Inmates are transported back to Angola to be buried here at the cemetery. However, there are some variations because while Angola makes a point of burying all of its inmates in at least some type of cheap casket, I saw one prisoner from another prison buried in a crude box built of recycled packing crate with the company's 800 number still on it.
Are lifers afraid of dying in prison? What does it mean to them?
Dying in prison is the convict's worst nightmare. I spoke to a prisoner here who's dying of AIDS in a prison hospital.
Who is he? Tell us something about him.
He's Alvin Howard. He's 51 years old, and he's been here since 1967, serving life for rape and murder. He's a maximum security custody inmate. And I visited him at the hospital, where he's kept in solitary confinement in a small room.
You're spending what's left of your life in a prison hospital. Could you describe what your life is like? Let me ask you, right now we're sitting in a cell. Normally you're locked in this cell, segregated from everybody else. Would you describe your cell for us?
Okay, the cell that I'm in right now is about 8'7". I'm locked in this cell 24 hours a day. I have a little shower in it, toilet, one face bowl, a bed, and because of the AIDS disease, they give me special bags to put my garbage in, special bags to put my laundry in. Whenever I get visitation, they put shackles on me, handcuff me around my waist. Whenever I talk to anybody.
You're wearing shackles, handcuffs.
Yes, this is a prison rule. You know, if you're in maximum security, you got to wear this. But there are others, some guards who does it and some don't.
How are the medical personnel treated?
Well, the doctor, Dr. Burns, is my doctor assigned to the AID case. And yeah, I believe, you know, he had been doing what he could. But the nurse staff is tremendous, you know. They are that friendly way of smiling, asking could they do anything for you, any help they can give to you, you know. And And they're held very helpful, you know, and if you're hurting, they'll try to get you a pain pill or something like that. They'll call the doctor, see what they can do, you know. But, you know, when you have AIDS, man, it's really not too much you can do. You can only depend on God for spiritual healing, I guess, you know. Other than that, you know, it is something that is known that will kill you, you know. There has been no proof of no one to recover from it yet, you know. Mm-hmm. No evidence, you know.
So there is a chance you may, if you die, whenever you die, you may very well end up being left in prison and buried on Point Lookout.
A great principle. A great possibility, believe me, a very great possibility that I'll be buried right here in penitentiary. In other words, I would never leave penitentiary, not even in debt.
You ever dreamed of dying in prison?
Yes. In fact, there were times it's haunting me. Sometimes I've even seen my whole funeral. I could see myself laying in a coffin, you know, sometimes, you know, and I wake up and sweat, you know, and it's like a nightmare, you know. And because it stays on your mind, the person, regardless of what he may say, that's going always stay on his mind. When he knows that he's close to one step to the graveyard, and if nothing can stop it, you know, really, you know, unless something, like I said, some miraculous spiritual healing, you know, it's about the only way out. And I wake up, man, sometimes sweating, and I done seen my part, the funeral, you know, and there's always been no one there but a preacher.
Wilbert Alvin Howard seems to assume that he'll be buried in the prison cemetery, Point Lookout. Why does he assume that?
Well, according to what he told me, he's not in touch with his family. He doesn't have anybody who visits him. So it's reasonable to assume that there's not going to be anybody to claim his body. Obviously, he doesn't expect there to be.
Alvin Howard does not want to be buried in the prison cemetery, Point Lookout. Do most prisons have prison cemeteries?
Most no, but there are 19 states that maintain their own prison cemeteries for the interment of, you know, unclaimed inmates. There are 10 other states that used to have cemeteries that they no longer use, but there's something about those systems that have prison cemeteries. They tend to, regardless of the individual differences, they tend to strive to give a measure of dignity to the burial of the inmates who died in their custody, complete with the formal funeral ceremonies at the grave site, as well as letting inmate friends and others attend the funeral services. But for other states, for a lot of the other states, it's just a matter of getting rid of an unwanted carcass that has disrupted their prison routine.
I'm speaking with Wilbert Rideau, who reports on life in prison for Fresh Air. He's the editor emeritus of The Angolite, the news magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, where he's serving a life sentence. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We're swinging
low,
so low,
sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Swinging low,
joining us by phone is prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau. He's serving a life sentence at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. We're talking about dying in prison and the medical care of dying inmates. Would you describe the medical facility for us?
It's actually a very small infirmary with drab-colored walls. There's two wards. There are two wards. One for ongoing medical treatment, and the other is more or less an old folks' ward where people more or less wait to die. One ward has 30 beds, the other 40. I talked to some of the nurses about caring for dying patients, like Alvin.
Let's hear what they had to say.
My name is Ella Lorena Fletcher. I'm a hospital administrator. I'm also a registered nurse. The patients and the nursing staff arrive at a kind of mutual accommodation space, if you will. Mm-hmm. They each learn about the other when the patient is in the dying process. So there's a little give and take, more so probably with a patient who's dying than there is with somebody who comes in for a short period of time and gets well and gets discharged out into the general population. So the nurses probably are closer to the dying inmates than they are to those who are not. By virtue of the fact that there's no real danger to the nurses in becoming a little bit closer to a person who will die.
Stacy Kent, I'm a registered nurse and I'm employed as assistant director of nurses at Angola. You see the an extreme in every direction. Every person reacts differently to death and to dying. I've seen many inmates who wouldn't talk at all. They didn't move through the grief process as they should have, and that may be one of our faults here in prisons, that we don't have psychologists or social workers that are with them and help them move through the grief process. But many inmates won't speak at all about it, and there are some that you can't shut them up with a bullet. That they're going to talk, you know, until the end. And I think that's bound to be what's best, as long as you can verbalize, even if it's just with the nurses. And we're not psychologists, we're nurses, but I think it helps that we're there for a sounding board.
My name is Shirley Cavan. I'm a registered nurse. I'm the head nurse on the inpatient unit at the Hospital at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. I worked here once before for about 5 years, and I've been back since about 6 months now. The difficult thing about taking care of patients is, as a nurse, I'm a toucher. Mm-hmm. And in a prison setting, you can't go sit down on the bedside and talk to your patient or pat them on the shoulder or, you know, do things like that for fear of it being misconstrued. They seem to die a little with less fight than I've seen on the streets. They don't. Some of them, I've seen a couple that have been kind of angry, but the majority of them just seem to be more accepting, or sometimes you wonder if maybe they don't really understand that they're really terminal patients. The last time I was here, there was a man on the ward that died, and I was very sad because he had been very protective of me. When we'd get inmates on the ward that would act up, he'd go shake his finger and say, "You can't treat Miss Cavan that way." And when he died, it bothered me.
Wilbur, for prisoners who are dying, does the prison make any distinctions between prisoners who have behaved very well over the years and those who have not?
No. They're all going to die in the same place. They're all treated pretty much the same. The only thing that good behavior over the years will get you is perhaps maybe some officer might do you a little extra favor and let you get something extra that you shouldn't have gotten, that's not being given to somebody else who he doesn't like. It boils down to individual relationships. But insofar as the prison operation making a difference, regulations accommodating or extending some extra benefit or a little mercy or favor or whatever to people who are dying, no, that's nothing. It's, you know, this is a, you just die. You're just like anybody else. You just die.
Wilbert, have you known a lot of people who have died in prison?
Yes. Too many. In fact, more than I can recall, more than I even want to recall. I've seen too many people die.
What was the last funeral you attended at Angola?
The last funeral I attended was that of Calvin Clark, a gay inmate who was rather popular. He had a lot of friends, and all of them were, not all of them, but a contingent of trusty inmates, along with Calvin's brother, were permitted to attend his funeral. I took the tape recorder with me.
An old rusted white bus is already here, probably what they use to transport the grave diggers. Chaplain Simon has just rolled up in an old white Ford. Three security officers are present, aside from one bus driver who brought us trustees. Okay, here comes the hearse behind us. That's fast.
Yeah, it was.
Warden Frank is out here. Eight big stripers are standing at the head of the grave against the white fence. Security officer just told them to back up, go around the mound of dirt.
Bones and brothering, I declare unto you the gospel of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That gospel that I preached unto you, whereby you are also saved.
Three.
Keep in memory.
Three inmates serving as pallbearers. We carry a cheap gray coffin. I set it atop the grave.
I have delivered unto you, first of all, that which also I received, how that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures.
A prison funeral recorded by Wilbert Rideau. He's our prison correspondent and editor emeritus of The Angleite, the news magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, where he's serving a life sentence. He's also co-editor of the anthology, Life Sentences. His report was produced by Naomi Person with Nancy Updike. We're going to end with a song, sung by Roosevelt Green, recorded at the penitentiary by Angleite staff writer Keith Elliott. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Lord, when my work is done, and Lord, when my race has been run, Lord, when you come back to carry me home, I want to sing with the angels over there. Lord, you know, Master, you know, that I'm doing my best. 'Cause I promised you, Master, that I would try and stand the test. But when Gable's horn awakened me, Lord, and you come back to carry me home, I want to sing with the angels over there. I told him, I said, I'm not worried, no, 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 about my starry crown. And Lord, I'm not worried about my long white robe. But every time.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A new PBS special pays tribute to the lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein. Coming up, we meet Hammerstein's son, Jamie. He handles the Hammerstein estate and has directed revivals of his father's musicals, including Carousel, South Pacific, Flower Drum Song, Oklahoma, and The King and I. Actor James Earl Jones is starring in a new TV series called Under One Roof. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House Ways and Means Committee has adopted a Republican plan for tax cuts. Democrats allege the plan, featured in the GOP's Contract with America, is fundamentally flawed and have abandoned most efforts to change it. The Democrats offered one amendment, an end to the tax cuts after 5 years. This was defeated on a party-line vote of 21 to 14. No more amendments were offered. The committee adopted the package by the same vote. Sinn Féin, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army, has opened an office in Washington to lobby Congress and promote the Irish nationalist cause. The Clinton administration has, for the first time, authorized Sinn Féin to raise funds in the United States and has invited Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams to the White House. NPR's Tom Jolton reports.
The Clinton administration dropped long-standing restrictions on Sinn Féin's activities in the United States after Gerry Adams agreed that discussing the disarmament of the IRA could be an agenda item if the British government agrees to hold high-level talks with Sinn Féin. British Prime Minister John Major promptly urged President Clinton to pressure Adams to move on disarmament. But at the opening of the Sinn Féin office in Washington, Gerry Adams said peace in Northern Ireland depends on John Major, not Sinn Féin.
We need John Major to talk peace. He talks an awful lot about Sinn Féin. Why can't he talk to Sinn Féin?
Administration officials are playing down their dispute with the British government over the Adams visit, saying the Sinn Féin president will be just a social guest at the St. Patrick's Day reception at the White House on Friday. I'm Tom Jolton in Washington.
President Clinton has nominated Lieutenant General Charles Krulak to be the 31st Commandant of the Marine Corps. If the Senate approves the nomination, Krulak will take over as head of the Corps in July. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
Krulak is currently the commander of Marine Forces Pacific, based in Hawaii. The 53-year-old Marine is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He served two tours in Vietnam and during the Persian Gulf War commanded the development of the Marine Combat Logistics Base and Ammunition Supply Point. Krulak would replace retiring Marine Corps Commandant Carl Mundy and assume his role as a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Mundy has been a controversial figure, suggesting at one point that the Marines prohibit married recruits from joining the Corps. In a statement issued by President Clinton, the president praised Krulak for his dynamic vision of the Marine Corps' future. The announcement of Krulak's nomination was made in Iwo Jima, Japan, at ceremonies commemorating the 50th anniversary of one of the most famous Marine Corps battles in history. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Stock prices closed in record territory today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up nearly 24 points to end the day at 4,048.75. Advances overwhelmed declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR. The Commerce Department says Americans cut spending on a wide variety of products in February. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
Retail sales fell 0.5% last month, continuing a trend toward less consumption. Purchases were off in virtually all major categories, led by a 1% drop in autos. Sales of other big-ticket items or durable goods were also off, as were non-durables. Sales of furniture, building materials, even food were down. Only gasoline stations managed a slight increase. Analysts had expected a small rise in retail sales. The sales drop wasn't as bad as it seemed, since January sales were revised up to show a much bigger gain than first reported. Still, since the start of the fourth quarter, sales have weakened sharply, tending to confirm fears the economy is losing steam. If consumption stays weak, factory orders and, in turn, output can be expected to slow, ultimately leading to higher unemployment. Some analysts think spending will rebound as recent strong job gains generate income needed to fuel demand for goods and services, but others note income gains have barely kept up with inflation. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
The crew of the space shuttle Endeavour has cheered the launch of a Russian rocket that vaulted an American astronaut into space. The Russian crew is going to link up with the Mir space station in a couple of days. The Endeavour crew hopes to congratulate U.S. astronaut Norman Thagard by radio then. Meanwhile, the Endeavour astronauts are working on their astronomy mission. Their flight will end Friday. They will set a shuttle record of 15 and a half days in space. Californians are cleaning up from a series of devastating storms. Floodwaters mixed with raw sewage from treatment plants have covered vast sections of the Monterey Peninsula, causing health hazards for some residents. White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta is visiting the flooded parts of California. He'll get a firsthand look at the damage and return to Washington to brief President Clinton. Losses to the state's lettuce crop alone are estimated at $500 million. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A PBS special this month pays tribute to the lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein. His son Jamie provides a tour of the family farm where Hammerstein wrote many of his songs. We invited Jamie to talk with us about his father. Oscar Hammerstein's musicals appear to be as popular as ever. Carousel was recently revived in New York, and now a Howell Prince production of Showboat is a Broadway hit. Jamie Hammerstein has directed many revivals of his father's musicals, including The Sound of Music, Oklahoma, South Pacific, and The King and I. Jamie also handles the Hammerstein estate. I asked him a very hypothetical question. Say I was mounting a revival of Oklahoma. What would I need to get from Jamie Hammerstein and the estate before starting my production?
Total permission, and we would put artistic strings on things so that we would have final decision as to who your director would be, who the major stars would be, if there are any, and hopefully there wouldn't for Oklahoma, because they're about young people there. If you get stars, it's usually wrong. And we would have a casting approval, director approval, lighting designer approval, and we would use them.
Now, would I resent you for exercising this control over my production?
Yeah. Well, it would tend. Yeah, that could be. A lot of people resent, and they say we didn't allow the show to come in. And really, the truth was we never gave their permission. They just hoped we would give it to them later. And very often we don't sit over somebody's shoulder. It depends on who it is. Mm-hmm. Nick Heitner is a director that I've admired for a long time.
And he did Carousel last
year.
Yes,
and when he came with Carousel, I said, whoop, we don't have to watch over this guy. This guy is going to do what he wants, and we're going to let him do it, and we're going to back him to the hilt. Because that's the best way to protect ourselves, is to back him to the hilt. It varies. We're in the theater. Mary Rogers and myself have been in the theater since we were children. It isn't as if we're not aware of what artistic freedom means and how necessary that is for the people doing it.
Mary Rogers is Richard Rogers' daughter?
Yes.
A few years ago, the conductor John McGlynn put together a restored version of Showboat on CD. And he took songs that had been taken out of the original production and put them in, and restored some of the original language which had been taken out of subsequent productions, most notably in the song Old Man River, which had over the years been sung as Color Folks Work on the Mississippi and Here We All Work on the Mississippi. He restored the original words, which were Niggers All Work on the Mississippi.
Right.
There was a big controversy over whether that was racist or whether the use of the word nigger was an indictment of the racism of the time. Did you have to give your permission for that? And where did you stand on that controversy?
Actually, I stand on the latter. I was doing a show.
The latter is that it's an indictment of the racism of the time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I know
so that it's okay to use it.
I'm a white person. I cannot say it's okay if it offends 45 million black people. It's not okay. But at the same time, it was meant as an indictment of white people. There's no doubt about that. And if you study black history at all, you will find that the word nigger probably was the nicest word somebody could use about a black person in 1888. And we don't want to go in what the other words were. But times have changed, so it's a little bit like turning your back on history and inventing other words like colored folk, which at the time that the play takes place hadn't been invented. So what are you going to do? But I mean, I will bend on something like that. I'm not in this business to make people unhappy.
Do you remember what it was like for your father when he kept trying to update the language of that song and change it as the decades changed?
I don't know. He was. I think what I've said he would say better. But I would think that he would recognize that he was unwittingly insulting people, and therefore he would change it.
Mm-hmm.
Because his intention was not to insult them at all. His intention was that... his intention was to write a protest song for black people, I think. And if the words don't fit the protest song because times have changed, then he's got to change the words. But I think for a lyricist to purposely use the wrong word, it's a little tough, but it's worth it.
My guest is theater director Jamie Hammerstein. He's the son of lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Jamie Hammerstein is my guest, and he's a theater director, past president of the Society of Stage Directors and Choreographers, and son of the great lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. Your family really has quite a theater legacy. I mean, your father, of course, was Oscar Hammerstein, the lyricist. Your grandfather was in vaudeville?
Yeah, he was a vaudeville producer. My great uncle was an operetta producer, and my great-grandfather was Oscar I, who was an opera impresario, among other things, a real estate developer and vaudeville himself and an inventor.
So theater was the family business when you were growing up?
Yes, but you'd never know it. It was not what people imagine with Judy Garland running in with a tennis racket. I mean, it just wasn't. It seemed like, well, you know, it's the only life I had as a kid, so it seemed perfectly normal to me. And my father wrote in his study and for many hours every day, and he'd come out having, I'm sure, sweated bullets all day. And he would come out and go, who's winning the baseball game? Or do you want a game of tennis? Or, you know, and you'd never guess he'd been working for 8 hours trying to find a rhyme for Surrey, you know?
Well, did he walk around the house going, Surrey, scurry, Surrey, scurry?
No, he locked himself in, or he walked in down the we had a long yard where he would also pace. And we also, for one of his mother, built him a walk-around porch from his study so that nice weather, or even reasonable weather, he could take a walk by opening his study door. He always worked walking, and he was inaudible. I know he worked terribly hard, and I know he was a perfectionist. There's no doubt in my mind about those things, but he also could turn it off like a light and come out as one of the more normal people you've ever met.
Hmm. I guess that's unusual in theater.
It's unusual with a writer,
being
I think.
Normal.
It's unreasonable. I mean, I think it's unreasonable. Yeah, I think it's almost supernatural myself.
Your father was Stephen Sondheim's mentor. I think it was when Sondheim's parents divorced when he was, I don't know, 10 or 11 or something, that he and his mother moved to rural Pennsylvania, or suburban Pennsylvania, where your family was living.
You got the facts right, but the order wrong. His parents had been divorced. He was living with his mother, and he came out to play with me one weekend, because he's a year and a day older than me. I know that because we shared birthdays for year in and year out. And he came out because we had just met and liked one another, and we had a good time. And instead of going off to camp, he decided to stay. He was the boy who came to dinner. He never left. Then his mother moved out to be close to us and see her son once in a while, because he literally moved in. And I think, you know, it's odd. I was thinking last night about that. And how much Steve owes my father, though I think he would be pretty much of a great writer if my father had not taken him in. But also my mother. I think that I think my both my parents were kind of adopted by Steve and vice versa. And he was like another brother, I suppose.
How did you feel about him moving in?
I don't know. He didn't bother me that much. We had a good time. You know, we fought like brothers fight, but we didn't... I don't think I felt any great jealousy. My father had a strangely objective form of love, which sounds like an impossibility. But he wrote about it a lot, and he thought about it a lot because he was writing about it. He had kind of an objectivity about it. And so it never became like a favoritism or... no, it just didn't happen. As far as I know, maybe I should go to a psychiatrist and find out what really happened.
How old were you when your father became partners with Richard Rodgers?
I was about 11.
So what do you know about the story of how he started to work with Richard Rodgers?
Well, Dick was approached by the Theater Guild to make a musical out of Green Grow the Lilacs. And he went to Larry Hart. And Larry Hart said, I'm not interested. And Dick still thought he could persuade Larry and went to Dad just in case and said, if Larry quits on me in the middle of this, will you save me? And my father said, if Larry doesn't want to do it or quits, I will not only do it, but I'll let Larry's name stay on it if you like. I'll just sit in the back and do the work. And then Larry actually insisted that he didn't want to do it. And so Dick went back to Dad and said, no, this is yours. And that's how it happened.
It's always been so interesting to me and probably everybody else who who listens to musicals, how different your father's lyrics were than Larry Hart's lyrics.
Yeah, but I think the really interesting part about it is how different Dick's music was.
Yeah, right. What do you perceive of how his music changed when
your father
became a lyricist?
They're totally different people. I mean, my goodness. I mean, Larry Hart and my father were night and day in the way they looked at life. My father was an optimist. My father believed optimism was the only useful thing to be. The pessimism was just a waste of time, basically. And my father was very not into writing songs. My father was into developing, was a dramatist who was also a lyricist. And Dick is a dramatist who's also a composer. And I think Dad gave Dick the chance to be a musical dramatist. I think Larry wrote songs. And my father wrote characters and plot and everything else in his songs. And I think that changed Dick. Dick's pretty smart cookie. You know, I don't think it was surprised him. I think he knew what he was in for right off the bat.
What did your father think of Larry Hart's lyrics?
Oh, he loved most of them. I mean, I think Larry Hart... See, my father never had a great facility for strange and wonderful rhymes. Larry Hart did. So it's like there's no competition involved. My father could never write like Larry Hart. I don't think Larry Hart could ever write like my father, no matter how hard either one of them tried. They couldn't do it. And my father, not being a fancy rhymer, just wrote very honestly and very easy to sing lyrics. But they were, I think he spent his time saying exactly what he wanted to say dramatically in what I think is the most difficult dramatic form you can write in, which is lyrics. You have to make things come out metrically. You've got to have rhymes, the right kind of rhymes, not too many of them if it's a serious song. If it's a light song, maybe triple rhymes, inside rhymes. It is something which takes years to master, and I think my father mastered it, and he... Just trying to say what you want to say in that form is deadly difficult. You can get so seduced by a very clever rhyme. You can get so seduced by an easy rhyme. And it just takes a little bit of the edge of what you're really trying to say, and it goes on some tangent, which isn't too far off. So let's take that tangent and get it over with and go have a drink. And my father would never do it. He'd keep on He'd just throw out more and more lyrics till he was saying what he wanted to say, and it, somehow it rhymed and was singable.
The songs that your father wrote are still sung on and off stage, and the musicals that he wrote are being revived now on Broadway. I mean, just in the past, what, year and a half or so, Carousel, Showboat. And revivals are becoming more and more important, I think, on Broadway. Do you have a sense that he ever suspected the songs would endure and that the musicals would endure in the way that they have?
No, I have a sense that he wouldn't have expected it to go that long. He had a pretty good-sized ego in a gentle sort of way. I mean, he's a very nice ego. I mean, you have to have an ego to have 11 years of flops and keep on writing. That's a useful kind of ego. But I don't think he would have dreamt of it. But I think there is an explanation. I do not think it's, like, so surprising. Why is it that we don't say, my God, they're reviving La Boheme at the Met? What's the big deal? What's the difference? The fact is that what happened during those years with, and, you know, when I grew up, I thought this is normal. You know, Frank Lesser, Cole Porter, my father. I thought there would always be people like that. And that was the golden age, and they created an art form. They didn't mean to. They wanted to make people happy and make some money. Probably that's what Puccini wanted to do. But they created an art form. And it's going to be revived until people get sick of it.
Well, Jamie Hammerstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very pleasant. Thank you.
Jamie Hammerstein is co-directing a revival of his father's musical State Fair, which will open in August in Des Moines. You can see Jamie Hammerstein in the PBS special that pays tribute to Oscar Hammerstein.
Must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have the story on Conoco, which considered doing some business in Iran. The president said no, and they reconsidered. Advocates for the arts are on Capitol Hill today asking if their funding can be saved. We have an art critic who says it should not be. Also, a chess team in Chicago, more on the suburbs. It'll be Portland this time. A special prosecutor will be named to investigate Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros and cutting school lunches. We'll ask what the Republican proposal really says and get the view from one state.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on CBS, James Earl Jones and Joe Morton star in Under One Roof, a new drama series about a middle-class family. What makes the show distinctive is that the family is African-American. According to TV critic David Bianculli, that distinction leaves him with two ways to review it.
One way to judge Under One Roof is to look at it in terms of TV history. In that way, it's hard to overestimate its importance. Nuclear families, where both parents are around to raise the kids, are a rarity on TV dramas no matter what race they are. But Under One Roof is the first time a cast of African Americans has starred in such a series since, well, since ever. This is the first time. So no matter what happens to Under One Roof, it matters. But the other way is to look at it colorblind and judge it purely against other family drama series. In that context, Under One Roof doesn't fare so well. If I say that my so-called life is brilliant, and I do, then I've got to say, by comparison, that Under One Roof is merely good. Put it above Family, below Life Goes On, and about on par with the Waltons. Under One Roof comes from Thomas Carter, who learned to act on The White Shadow and how to direct on that series and on Saint Elsewhere. The parents on Under One Roof are played by Joe Morton and Vanessa Bell Calloway, both of whom starred on Carter's last TV series, Equal Justice. They're both very strong, very good actors, But no one in Under One Roof matches the power of James Earl Jones, who plays the grandfather, Neb Langston. In the pilot, Neb is a doting grandfather but has less patience dealing with his 16-year-old foster child, a troubled teenager named Marcus who is played very well by Merlin Santana. It's when Marcus and Neb lock horns that Under One Roof has the most fire and presents the best work.
The principal of your school called me at work this afternoon.
Oh, man, some fool teacher disses me. And he was all over me, dogging me. I ain't do nothing. I mean, why you gonna be on some fool teacher side when you weren't even there?
I didn't have to be there to know that wearing a cap in school is against the rules.
Yeah, well, it's a stupid rule.
It's a stupid rule you're expected to obey. All you have to do is take the damn cap off.
You wore a cap? What's wrong, the blue one?
Derek.
I was gonna take it off, but before I could, he snatched it off my head. I ain't do nothing but stand there.
The way I heard it, you acted like a gangster. Now it's time you realize your life is different now. What was acceptable before is not anymore.
Don't be calling me no gangster, all right? Like I said, I was gonna take off the cap, but I forgot.
What you forgot was you could get suspended doing what you did, which is what happened, and it will not happen again. Derek, sit down. Marcus, come back here.
I'm not hungry.
Pop, let it go.
Marcus, get back in here.
I'm not hungry.
Get yourself back in here.
I said I'm not hungry.
I don't care if you're hungry or not. It's dinner time. In this family, we eat together.
Most of Under One Roof, though, is pat and predictable. Tonight's plot, for example, deals with such universal TV themes as a daughter who borrows her mother's credit card and a father whose job duties conflict with his ability to show up for a father-son school function. There's nothing wrong with the familiarity of these storylines, but Under One Roof doesn't do anything new or special with them. Bill Cosby, who broke the color barrier for TV dramatic series stars with I Spy back in the 60s, was asked in the 80s, after the phenomenal success of The Cosby Show, when he thought TV shows would be judged on their own merits rather than as black or white shows. Cosby's answer was, when people like you stop asking questions like that. He has a point. The problem with Amos and Andy wasn't that it wasn't funny, it was, but that it was the only show of its type on TV. If whites were represented on TV only by Gomer Pyle, that'd be offensive too. 40 years later, there's a wide range of sitcoms featuring black stars and casts. But in the drama category, TV still has a lot of work to do. Under One Roof is James Earl Jones' third starring role in a dramatic TV series, adding to his fine work on Paris and Gabriel's Fire. All by himself, Jones represents a hefty percentage of all TV drama series starring African Americans. And no matter how talented James Earl Jones is, that's a shame.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Updike and Kathy Wolf. Becky Cohn is our research assistant. Alan Tu directed today's show. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Afterlife Diet, a new novel by NPR commentator Daniel Pinkwater. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Falk about his years as Columbo, his work with John Cassavetes, and his new movie, Roommates. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.